Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of Prey by Michael Crichton, narrated by George Wilson, with an introduction read by the author. This work is copyrighted 2002 by Michael Crichton. This recording is copyrighted 2002 by Recorded Books. The book begins with the following quote. Within 50 to 100 years, a new class of organisms is likely to emerge. These organisms will be artificial in the sense that they will originally be designed by humans. However, they will reproduce and will evolve into something other than their original form. They will be alive under any reasonable definition of the word. These organisms will evolve in a fundamentally different manner. The pace will be extremely rapid. The impact on humanity and the biosphere could be enormous. Larger than the Industrial Revolution, nuclear weapons, or environmental pollution. We must take steps now to shape the emergence of artificial organisms. Doyne Farmer and Aletta Bellin, 1991. There are many people, including myself, who are quite queasy about the consequences of this technology for the future. K. Eric Drexler, 1992. And now, Prey.
Introduction. Artificial Evolution in the 21st Century. The notion that the world around us is continuously evolving is a platitude. We rarely grasp its full implications. We don't ordinarily think, for example, of an epidemic disease changing its character as the epidemic spreads. Nor do we think of evolution in plants and animals as occurring in a matter of days or weeks, though it does. And we don't ordinarily imagine the green world around us as a scene of constant, sophisticated chemical warfare, with plants producing pesticides in response to attack and insects developing resistance. But that's what happens, too. If we were to grasp the true nature of nature, if we could comprehend the real meaning of evolution, then we would envision a world in which every living plant, insect, and animal species is changing at every instant in response to every other living plant, insect, and animal. Whole populations of organisms are rising and falling, shifting and changing. This restless and perpetual change, as inexorable and unstoppable as the waves and tides, implies a world in which all human actions necessarily have uncertain effects. The total system we call the biosphere is so complicated that we can't know in advance the consequences of anything that we do. That's why even our most enlightened past efforts have had undesirable outcomes, either because we did not understand enough, or because the ever-changing world responded to our actions in unexpected ways. From this standpoint, the history of environmental protection is as discouraging as the history of environmental pollution. Anyone who is willing to argue, for example, that the industrial policy of clear-cutting forests is more damaging than the ecological policy of fire suppression ignores the fact that both policies have been carried out with utter conviction and both have altered the virgin forest irrevocably. Both provide ample evidence of the obstinate egotism that is a hallmark of human interaction with the environment. The fact that the biosphere responds unpredictably to our actions is not an argument for inaction. It is, however, a powerful argument for caution and for adopting a tentative attitude toward all we believe and all we do. Unfortunately, our species has demonstrated a striking lack of caution in the past. It's hard to imagine that we will behave differently in the future. We think we know what we're doing. We have always thought so. We never seem to acknowledge that we have been wrong in the past, and so might be wrong in the future. Instead, each generation writes off earlier errors as the result of bad thinking by less able minds, and then confidently embarks on fresh errors of its own. We are one of only three species on our planet that can claim to be self-aware, Yet self-delusion may be a more significant characteristic of our kind. Sometime in the 21st century, our self-deluded recklessness will collide with our growing technological power. One area where this will occur is in the meeting point of nanotechnology, biotechnology, and computer technology. What all three have in common is the ability to release self-replicating entities into the environment. We have lived for some years with the first of these self-replicating entities, computer viruses, and we're beginning to have some practical experience with the problems of biotechnology. The recent report that modified maize genes now appear in native maize in Mexico ought to be a long and difficult journey to control our technology. At the same time, long-standing beliefs about the fundamental safety of biotechnology, views that have been promoted by the great majority of biologists since the 1970s, now appear less secure. The unintended creation of a devastatingly lethal virus by Australian researchers in 2001 has caused many to rethink old assumptions. Clearly, we will not be as casual about this technology in the future as we have been in the past. Nanotechnology is the newest of these three technologies, and in some ways the most radical. It's the quest to build man-made machinery of extremely small size, on the order of 100 nanometers, or 100 billionths of a meter. Such machines would be about 1,000 times smaller than the diameter of a human hair. Pundits predict these tiny machines will provide everything from miniaturized computer components to new cancer treatments to new weapons of war. As a concept, nanotechnology dates back to a 1959 speech by Richard Feynman called "There's Plenty of Room at the Bottom." 40 years later, the field is still very much in its infancy despite relentless media hype. Yet practical advances are now being made, and funding has increased dramatically. Major corporations such as IBM, Fujitsu, and Intel are pouring money into research. The U.S. government has spent $1 billion on nanotechnology in the last 2 years. Meanwhile, nanotechniques are already being used to make sunscreens, stain-resistant fabrics, and composite materials in cars. Soon they will be used to make computers and storage devices of extremely small size. And some of the long-anticipated miracle products have started to appear as well. In 2002, one company was manufacturing self-cleaning window glass. Another made a nanocrystal wound dressing with antibiotic and anti-inflammatory properties. At the moment, nanotechnology is primarily a materials technology, but its potential goes far beyond that. For decades, there has been speculation about self-reproducing machines. In 1980, a NASA paper discussed several methods by which such machines could be made. 10 years ago, two knowledgeable scientists took the matter seriously, and I quote them, "Within 50 to 100 years, a new class of organisms is likely to emerge. These organisms will be artificial in the sense that they will originally be designed by humans. However, they will reproduce and will evolve into something other than their original form. They will be alive under any reasonable definition of the word. The pace of evolutionary change will be extremely rapid. The impact on humanity and the biosphere could be enormous, larger than the Industrial Revolution, nuclear weapons, or environmental pollution. We must take steps now to shape the emergence of artificial organisms." End of quote. And the chief proponent of nanotechnology, K. Eric Drexler, once expressed related concerns, and I'll quote him, "There are many people, including myself, who are quite queasy about the consequences of this technology for the future. We are talking about changing so many things that the risk of society handling it poorly through lack of preparation is very large." End of quote. even by the most optimistic or dire predictions, such organisms are probably decades into our future. We may hope that by the time they emerge, we will have settled upon international controls for self-reproducing technology. We can expect such controls to be stringently enforced. Already we have learned to treat computer virus makers with a severity unthinkable 20 years ago. We've learned to put hackers in jail. Errant biotechnologists will soon join them. But of course, it is always possible that we will not establish controls, or that someone will manage to create artificial self-reproducing organisms far sooner than anyone expected. If so, it's difficult to anticipate what the consequences might be. That is the subject of the present novel. Michael Crichton, Los Angeles, 2002.
It's midnight now. The house is dark. I'm not sure how this will turn out. The kids are all desperately sick, throwing up. I can hear my son and daughter retching in separate bathrooms. I went in to check on them a few minutes ago to see what was coming up. I'm worried about the baby, but I had to make her sick, too. It was her only hope. I think I'm okay, at least for the moment, but of course the odds aren't good. Most of the people involved in this business are already dead, and there are so many things I can't know for sure. The facility is destroyed, but I don't know if we did it in time. I'm waiting for May. She went to the lab in Palo Alto 12 hours ago. I hope she succeeded. I hope she made them understand how desperate the situation is. I expected to hear from the lab, but so far there has been no word. I have ringing in my ears, which is a bad sign, and I feel a vibrating in my chest and abdomen. The baby is spitting up, not really vomiting. I am feeling dizzy. I hope I don't lose consciousness. The kids need me, especially the little one. They're frightened. I don't blame them. I am, too. Sitting here in the dark, it's hard to believe that a week ago my biggest problem was finding a job. It seems almost laughable now. But then, things never turn out the way you think they will. Home. Day 1, 10:04 a.m. Things never turn out the way you think they will. I never intended to become a house husband, stay-at-home husband, full-time dad, whatever you want to call it. There is no good term for it. But that's what I had become in the last 6 months. Now I was in Crate and Barrel in downtown San Jose, picking up some extra glasses, and while I was there I noticed they had a good selection of placemats. We needed more placemats. The woven oval ones that Julia had bought a year ago were getting pretty worn, and the weave was crusted with baby food. The trouble was, they were woven, so you couldn't wash them. So I stopped at the display to see if they had any placemats that might be good, and I found some pale blue ones that were nice, and I got some white napkins, and then some yellow placemats caught my eye, because they looked really bright and appealing, so I got those too. They didn't have 6 on the shelf, and I thought we'd better have 6, so I asked the sales girl to look in the back and see if they had more. While she was gone, I put the placemat on the table and put a white dish on it, and then I put the yellow napkin next to it. The setting looked very cheerful, and I began to think maybe I should get 8 instead of 6. That was when my cell phone rang. It was Julia. "Hi, hon." "Hi, Julia. How's it going?" I said. I could hear machinery in the background, a steady chugging, probably the vacuum pump for the electron microscope. They had several scanning electron microscopes at her laboratory. She said, "What are you doing?" "Buying placemats, actually." "Where?" "Crate and Barrel." She laughed. "You the only guy there?" "No." "Oh, well, that's good," she said. I could tell Julia was completely uninterested in this conversation. Something else was on her mind. Listen, I wanted to tell you, Jack, I'm really sorry, but it's going to be a late night again. Uh-huh. The salesgirl came back, carrying more yellow mats. Still holding the phone to my ear, I beckoned her over. I held up three fingers, and she put down three more mats. To Julia, I said, "Is everything all right?" "Yeah, it's just crazy, like normal. We're broadcasting a demo by satellite today to the VCs in Asia and Europe, and we're having trouble with the satellite hookup at this end because the video truck they sent... Oh, you don't want to know. Anyway, we're going to be delayed 2 hours, hon, maybe more. I won't get back until 8 at the earliest. Can you feed the kids and put them to bed?" "No problem," I said. And it wasn't. I was used to it. Lately, Julia had been working very long hours. Most nights she didn't get home until the children were asleep. Zymos Technologies, the company she worked for, was trying to raise another round of venture capital, $20 million, and there was a lot of pressure, especially since Zymos was developing technology in what the company called molecular manufacturing, but which most people called nanotechnology. Nano wasn't popular with the VCs, the venture capitalists, these days. Too many VCs had been burned in the last 10 years with products that were supposedly just around the corner, but then never made it out of the lab. The VCs considered nano to be all promise, no products. Not that Julia needed to be told that. She'd worked for two VC firms herself. Originally trained as a child psychologist, she ended up as someone who specialized in technology incubation, helping fledgling technology companies get started. She used to joke she was still doing child psychology. Eventually, she'd stopped advising firms and joined one of them full-time. She was now a vice president at Zymos. Julia said Zymos had made several breakthroughs and was far ahead of others in the field. She said they were just days away from a prototype commercial product, but I took what she said with a grain of salt. "Listen, Jack, I want to warn you," she said in a guilty voice, "that Eric is going to be upset."
"Why?"
"Well, I told him I would come to the game." "Julia, why? We talked about making promises like this. There's no way you can make that game. It's at 3 o'clock. Why'd you tell him you would?"
"I thought I could make it."
I sighed. It was, I told myself, a sign of her caring. "Okay, don't worry, honey, I'll handle it."
"Thanks. Oh, and Jack, the placemats? Whatever you do, just don't get yellow, okay?"
And she hung up. I made spaghetti for dinner because there was never an argument about spaghetti. By 8 o'clock, the two little ones were asleep, and Nicole was finishing her homework. She was 12 and had to be in bed by 10 o'clock, though she didn't like any of her friends to know that. The littlest one, Amanda, was just 9 months. She was starting to crawl everywhere and to stand up, holding on to things. Then Eric was 8. He was a soccer kid and liked to play all the time when he wasn't dressing up as a knight and chasing his older sister around the house with his plastic sword. Nicole was in a modest phase of her life. Eric liked nothing better than to grab her bra and go running around the house shouting, "Nikki, where's a bra? Nikki, where's a bra?" While Nicole, too dignified to pursue him, gritted her teeth and yelled, "Dad, he's doing it again, Dad!" And I would have to go chase Eric and tell him not to touch his sister's things. This was what my life had become. At first, after I lost the job at Mediatronics, it was interesting to deal with sibling rivalry, and often it seemed not that different from what my job had been. At Mediatronics, I had run a program division, riding herd over a group of talented young computer programmers. At 40, I was too old to work as a programmer myself anymore. Writing code is a young person's job. So I managed the team, and it was a full-time job. Like most Silicon Valley programmers, my team seemed to live in a perpetual crisis of crashed Porsches, infidelities, bad love affairs, parental hassles, and drug reactions, all superimposed on a forced March work schedule with all-night marathons fueled by cases of Diet Coke and Sun chips. But the work was exciting, in a cutting-edge field. we wrote what are called distributed parallel processing, or agent-based programs. These programs model biological processes by creating virtual agents inside the computer, and then letting the agents interact to solve real-world problems. It sounds strange, but it works fine. For example, one of our programs imitated ant foraging, how ants find the shortest path to food, to route traffic through a big telephone network. Other programs mimic the behavior of termites, swarming bees, and stalking lions. It was fun, and I would probably still be there if I hadn't taken on some additional responsibilities. In my last few months there, I've been put in charge of security, replacing an outside tech consultant who'd had the job for 2 years, but had failed to detect the theft of company source code until it turned up in a program being marketed out of Taiwan. Actually, it was my division's source code, software for distributed processing. That was the code that had been stolen. We knew it was the same code because the Easter eggs hadn't been touched. Programmers always insert Easter eggs into their code, little nuggets that don't serve any useful purpose and are just put there for fun. The Taiwanese company hadn't changed any of them. They used our code wholesale. So the keystrokes, Alt-Shift-M9, would open up a window giving the date of one of our programmers' marriage. Clear theft. Of course, we sued, but Don Gross, the head of the company, wanted to make sure it didn't happen again. So he put me in charge of security, and I was angry enough about the theft to take the job. It was only part-time. I still ran the division. The first thing I did as security officer was to monitor workstation use. It was pretty straightforward. These days, 80% of companies monitor what their workers do at terminals. They do it by video, or they do it by recording keystrokes, or by scanning email for certain keywords. All sorts of procedures out there. Don Gross was a tough guy, an ex-Marine who had never lost his military manner. When I told him about the new system, he said, "But you're not monitoring my terminal, right?" "Of course not," I said. In fact, I'd set up the programs to monitor every computer in the company, his included. And that was how I discovered, 2 weeks later, that Don was having an affair with a girl in accounting and had authorized her to have a company car. I went to him and said that based on emails relating to Gene in accounting, it appeared that someone unknown was having an affair with her and that she might be getting perks she wasn't entitled to. I said I didn't know who the person was, but if they kept using email, I'd soon find out. I figured Don would take the hint, and he did. But now he just sent incriminating email from his home, never realizing that everything went through the company server and I was getting it all. That's how I learned he was discounting software to foreign distributors and taking large consultant fees into an account in the Cayman Islands. This was clearly illegal, and I couldn't overlook it. I consulted my attorney, Gary Marder, who advised me to quit. "Quit?" I said. "Yeah, of course." "Why?" "Who cares why? You've got a better offer elsewhere, you've got some health problems or some family issues, trouble at home. Just get out of there. Quit." "Wait a minute," I said. "You think I should quit because he's breaking the law? Is that your advice to me?" "No," Gary said. "As your attorney, my advice is that if you are aware of any illegal activity, you have a duty to report it. But as your friend, my advice is to keep your mouth shut and get out of there fast." Seems kind of cowardly. "I think I have to notify the investors." Gary sighed. He put his hand on my shoulder. "Jack," he said, "the investors can look out for themselves. You get the fuck out of there." I didn't think that was right. I had been annoyed when my code had been stolen. Now I found myself wondering if it had actually been stolen. Maybe it had been sold. We were a privately held company, and I told one of the board members. It turned out he was in on it. I was fired the next day for gross negligence and misconduct. Litigation was threatened. I had to sign a raft of NDAs in order to get my severance package. My attorney handled the paperwork for me, sighing with every new document. At the end, we went outside into the milky sunshine. I said, "Well, at least that's over." He turned and looked at me. "Why do you say that?" he said. Because, of course, it wasn't over. In some mysterious way, I had become a marked man. My qualifications were excellent, and I worked in a hot field. But when I went on job interviews, I could tell they weren't interested. Worse, they were uncomfortable. Silicon Valley covers a big area, but it's a small place. Word gets out. Eventually, I found myself talking to an interviewer I knew slightly, Ted Landau. I'd coached his kid in Little League baseball the year before. When the interview was over, I said to him, "What have you heard about me?" He shook his head. "Nothing, Jack." I said, "Ted, I've been on 10 interviews in 10 days. Tell me." "There's nothing to tell." "Ted." He shuffled through his papers, looking down at them, not at me. He sighed. "Jack Forman, troublemaker, not cooperative, belligerent, hot-headed, not a team player." He hesitated, then said, "And supposedly you were involved in some kind of dealings. They won't say what, but some kind of shady dealings. You were on the take." "I was on the take?" I said. I felt a flood of anger and started to say more, until I realized I was probably looking hot-headed and belligerent. So I shut up and thanked him. As I was leaving, he said, "Jack, do yourself a favor. Give it a while. Things change fast in the Valley. Your resume is strong and your skill set is outstanding. Wait until..." He shrugged. "A couple of months?" "I'd say 4, maybe 5. Somehow, I knew he was right. After that, I stopped trying so hard. I began to hear rumors that Mediatronics was going belly up, and there might be indictments. I smelled vindication ahead, but in the meantime, there was nothing to do but wait. The strangeness of not going to work in the morning slowly faded. Julia was working longer hours at her job, and the kids were demanding. If I was in the house, they turned to me instead of our housekeeper, Maria. I started taking them to school, picking them up, driving them to the doctor, the orthodontist, soccer practice. The first few dinners I cooked were disastrous, but I got better. And before I knew it, I was buying placemats and looking at table settings in Crate and Barrel. And it all seemed perfectly normal. Julia got home around 9:30. I was watching the Giants game on TV, not really paying attention. She came in and kissed me on the back of the neck. She said, "They all asleep?" "Except Nicole. She's still doing homework." "Geez, isn't it late for her to be up?" "No, hon," I said. "We agreed. This year she gets to stay up until 10, remember?" Julia shrugged as if she didn't remember. And maybe she didn't. We had undergone a sort of inversion of roles. She had always been more knowledgeable about the kids, but now I was. Sometimes Julia felt uncomfortable with that, experiencing it somehow as a loss of power. "How's the little one?" "Her cold is better, just sniffles. She's eating more." I walked with Julia to the bedrooms. She went into the baby's room, bent over the crib, and kissed the sleeping child tenderly. Watching her, I thought there was something about a mother's caring that a father could never match. Julia had some connection to the kids that I never would, or at least a different connection. She listened to the baby's soft breathing and said, "Yes, she's better." Then she went into Eric's room, took the Game Boy off the bed covers, gave me a frown. I shrugged, faintly irritated. I knew Eric played with this Game Boy when he was supposed to be going to sleep, but I was busy getting the baby down at that time, and I overlooked it. I thought Julia should be more understanding. Then she went into Nicole's room. Nicole was on her laptop, but shut the lid when her mother walked in.
Hi, Mom.
You're up late.
No, Mom. You're supposed to be doing homework.
I did it.
Then why aren't you in bed?
Because I don't want you spending all night talking to your friends on the computer.
Mom,
she said in a pained voice. You see them every day at school. That should be enough.
Mom, don't look at your father. We already know he'll do whatever you want. I'm talking to you now.
She sighed.
I know, Mom.
This kind of interaction was increasingly common between Nicole and Julia. I guess it was normal at this age, but I thought I'd step in. Julia was tired, and when she was tired, she got rigid and controlling. I put my arm around her shoulder and said, "It's late for everybody. Want a cup of tea?"
"Jack, don't interfere."
"I'm not. I just..."
"Yes, you are. I'm talking to Nicole, and you're interfering, the way you always do."
"Honey, we all agreed she could stay up until 10.
I don't know what this..."
"But if she's finished her homework, she should go to bed."
"Well, that wasn't the deal.
I don't want her spending all day and night on the computer."
"She's not, Julia."
At that point, Nicole burst into tears and jumped to her feet, crying,
"You always criticize me. I hate you."
She ran into the bathroom and slammed the door. That woke the baby, who started to cry. Julia turned to me and said,
"If you would please just let me handle this myself, Jack."
And I said, "You're right. I'm sorry. You're right." In truth, that wasn't what I thought at all. More and more, I regarded this as my house and my kids. She was barging into my house late at night when I'd gotten everything quiet, the way I liked it, the way it should be, and she was raising a fuss. I didn't think she was right at all. I thought she was wrong. And in the last few weeks, I noticed that incidents like this had become more frequent. At first I thought Julia was guilty about being away so much. Then I thought she was reasserting her authority, trying to regain control of a household that had fallen into my hands. Then I thought it was because she was tired or under so much pressure at work. But lately, I felt I was making excuses for her behavior. I started to have the feeling Julia had changed. She was different somehow, tenser, tougher. The baby was howling. I picked her up from the crib, hugged her, cooed at her, and simultaneously stuck a finger down the back of the diaper to see if it was wet. It was. I put her down on her back on top of the dresser, and she howled again until I shook her favorite rattle and put it in her hand. She was silent then, allowing me to change her without much kicking.
"I'll do that," Julia said, coming in.
"It's okay.
I woke her up. It's only right I do it."
"Really, honey, it's fine." Julia put her hand on my shoulder, kissed the back of my neck.
"I'm sorry I'm such a jerk. I'm really tired. I don't know what came over me. Let me change the baby. I never get to see her."
"Okay," I said. I stepped aside, and she moved in.
"Hi, poopsie doopsie,"
she said, chucking the baby under the chin.
"How's my little winky-dinky?"
All this attention made the baby drop the rattle, and then she started to cry and to twist away on the table. Julia didn't notice the missing rattle caused the crying. Instead, she made soothing sounds and struggled to put on the new diaper, but the baby's twisting and kicking made it hard.
"Amanda, stop it!"
I said, "She does that now." And it was true. Amanda was in the stage where she actively resisted a diaper change, and she could kick pretty hard.
"Well, she should stop. Stop!"
The baby cried louder, tried to turn away. One of the adhesive tabs pulled off. The diaper slid down. Amanda was now rolling toward the edge of the dresser. Julia pulled her back roughly. Amanda never stopped kicking.
God damn it, I said stop, Julia said, and smacked the baby on the leg. The baby just cried harder, kicked harder. Amanda, stop it, stop it. She slapped her again. Stop it, stop it. For a moment, I didn't react. I was stunned. I didn't know what to do. The baby's legs were bright red. Julia was still hitting her. Honey, I said, leaning in. Let's not... Julia exploded. Why do you always fucking interfere? She yelled, slamming her hand down on the dresser. What is your fucking problem? And she stomped off, leaving the room. I let out a long breath and picked the baby up. Amanda howled inconsolably, as much in confusion as in pain. I figured I would need to give her a bottle to get her to sleep again. I stroked her back until she settled down a little. Then I got her diaper on and brought her into the kitchen while I heated a bottle. The lights were low, just the fluorescence over the counter. Julia was sitting at the table, drinking beer out of a bottle, staring into space. When are you going to get a job? She said. I'm trying. Really? I don't think you're trying at all. When was your last interview? Last week, I said. She grunted. I wish you'd hurry up and get one, she said, because this is driving me crazy. I swallowed anger. I know. It's hard for everybody, I said. It was late at night, and I didn't want to argue anymore, but I was watching her out of the corner of my eye. At 36, Julia was a strikingly pretty woman, petite, with dark hair and dark eyes, upturned nose, and the kind of personality that people called bubbly or sparkling. Unlike many tech executives, she was attractive and approachable. She made friends easily and had a good sense of humor. Years back, when we first had Nicole, Julia would come home with hysterical accounts of the foibles of her VC partners. We used to sit at the same kitchen table and laugh until I felt physically sick, while little Nicole would tug at her arm and say, "What's the funny, Mom? What's the funny?" because she wanted to be in on the joke. Of course, we could never explain it to her, but Julia always seemed to have a new knock-knock joke for Nicole, so she could join in the laughter, too. Julia had a real gift for seeing the humorous side of life. She was famous for her equanimity. She almost never lost her temper. Right now, of course, she was furious, not even willing to look at me. Sitting in the dark at the round kitchen table, one leg crossed over the other, kicking impatiently while she stared into space. As I looked at her, I had the feeling that her appearance had changed somehow. Of course, she had lost weight recently, part of the strain of the job. A certain softness in her face was gone. Her cheekbones protruded more. Her chin seemed sharper. It made her look harder, but in a way more glamorous. Her clothes were different, too. Julia was wearing a dark skirt and a white blouse, sort of standard business attire, but the skirt was tighter than usual, and her kicking foot made me notice she was wearing sling-back high heels, what she used to call fuck-me shoes, the kind of shoes she would never wear to work. And then I realized that everything about her was different. Her manner, her appearance, her mood, everything. And in a flash of insight, I knew why. My wife was having an affair. The water on the stove began to steam, and I pulled out the bottle, tested it on my forearm. It had gotten too hot, and I would have to wait a minute for it to cool. The baby started to cry, and I bounced her a little on my shoulder while I walked her around the room. Julia never looked at me. She just kept swinging her foot and staring into space. I had read somewhere that this was a syndrome. The husband's out of work, his masculine appeal declines, his wife no longer respects him, and she wanders. I had read that in Glamour or Red Book or one of those magazines around the house that I glanced through while waiting for the washing machine to finish its cycle, or the microwave to thaw the hamburger. But now I was flooded with confused feelings. Was it really true? Was I just tired making up bad stories in my mind? After all, what difference did it make if she was wearing tighter skirts and different shoes? Fashions changed. People felt different on different days. And just because she was sometimes angry, did that really mean she was having an affair? Of course it didn't. I was probably just feeling inadequate, unattractive. These were probably my insecurities coming out. My thoughts went on in this vein for a while. But for some reason, I couldn't talk myself out of it. I was sure it was true. I had lived with this woman for more than 12 years. I knew she was different, and I knew why. I could sense the presence of someone else, an outside person, some intruder into our relationship. I felt it with a conviction that surprised me. I felt it in my bones like an ache. I had to turn away. The baby took the bottle, gurgling happily. In the darkened kitchen, she stared up at my face with that peculiar fixed stare that babies have. It was sort of soothing watching her. After a while, she closed her eyes, and then her mouth went slack. I put her on my shoulder and burped her as I carried her back into her bedroom. Most parents pat their babies too hard trying to get a burp. It's better to just rub the flat of your hand up their back, and sometimes just along the spine with two fingers. She gave a soft belch and relaxed. I set her down in the crib, and I turned out the nightlight. Now the only light in the room came from the aquarium, bubbling green-blue in the corner. A plastic diver trudged along the bottom, trailing bubbles. As I turned to go, I saw Julia silhouetted in the doorway, dark hair backlit. She had been watching me. I couldn't read her expression. She stalked forward. I tensed. She put her arms around me and rested her head on my chest. "Please forgive me," she said. "I'm a real jerk. You're doing a wonderful job. I'm just jealous, that's all." My shoulder was wet with her tears. "I understand," I said, holding her. "It's okay." I waited to see if my body relaxed, but it didn't. I was suspicious and alert. I had a bad feeling about her, and it wasn't going away. She came out of the shower into the bedroom, toweling her short hair dry. I was sitting on the bed trying to watch the rest of the game. It occurred to me that she never used to take showers at night. Julia always took a shower in the morning before work. Now, I realized, she often came home and went straight to the shower before coming out to say hello to the kids. My body was still tense. I flicked the TV off. I said, "How was the demo?"
"The what?"
"The demo. Didn't you have a demo today?"
"Oh,"
she said.
"Oh, yes, we did. It went fine when we finally got it going. The VCs in Germany couldn't stay for all of it because of the time change, but listen, do you want to see it?"
"What do you mean?"
"I have a dub of it. Want to see it?"
I was surprised. I shrugged. "Okay, sure."
"I'd really like to know what you think, Jack."
I detected a patronizing tone. My wife was including me in her work, making me feel a part of her life. I watched as she opened her briefcase and took out a DVD. She stuck it in the player and came back to sit with me on the bed.
"What were you demoing?"
I said.
"The new medical imaging technology," she said. "It's really slick, if I say so myself."
She snuggled up, tucking herself into my shoulder. All very cozy, just like old times. I still felt uneasy, but I put my arm around her. "By the way," I said, "how come you take showers at night now instead of in the morning?"
"I don't know,"
she said.
"Do I?" "I guess I do. It just seems easier, honey. Mornings are so rushed, and I've been getting those conference calls from Europe. They take so much time." "Okay, here we go,"
she said, pointing to the screen. I saw a black and white scramble, and then the image resolved.
The tape showed Julia in a large laboratory that was fitted out like an operating room. A man lay on his back on the gurney, an IV in his arm, an anesthesiologist standing by. Above the table was a round, flat metal plate about 6 feet in diameter, which could be raised and lowered, but was now raised. There were video monitors all around, and in the foreground, peering at a monitor, was Julia. There was a video technician by her side.
"This is terrible," she was saying, pointing to the monitor. "What's all the interference?"
"We think it's the air purifiers. They're causing it."
"Well, this is unacceptable."
"Really?"
"Yes, really."
"What do you want us to do?"
"I want you to fix it," Julia said.
"Then we have to boost power, and you have..."
"I don't care," she said. "I can't show the VCs an image of this quality. They've seen better pictures from Mars. Fix it."
Beside me on the bed, Julia said, "I didn't know they recorded all this. This is before the demo. You can fast forward." I pushed the remote. The picture scrambled. I waited a few seconds and played it again. Same scene. Julia still in the foreground. Carol, her assistant, whispering to her.
"Okay, but what do I tell him?"
"Tell him no."
"But he wants to get started."
"I understand, but the transmission isn't for an hour. Tell him no."
On the bed, Julia said to me,
"Mad Dog was our experimental subject. He was very restless, impatient to get started."
On the screen, the assistant lowered her voice.
"I think he's nervous, Julia. I would be too with a couple of million of those things crawling around inside my body."
"It's not a couple of million, and they're not crawling," Julia said.
"Anyway, they're his invention."
"Even so.
Isn't that an anesthesiologist over there?"
"No, just a cardiologist."
"Well, maybe the cardiologist can give him something for his nervousness."
"They already did. An injection."
On the bed beside me, Julia said,
"Fast forward, Jack."
I did. The picture jumped ahead.
"Okay, here."
I saw Julia standing at the monitor again with the technician beside her.
"That's acceptable,"
on screen Julia was saying, pointing to the image.
"Not great, but acceptable. Now, show me the STM.
"The what?"
"The STM, the electron microscope. Show me the image from that."
The technician looked confused.
Nobody told us about any electron microscope." "For God's sake, read the damn storyboards."
The technician blinked. "It's on the storyboards?"
"Did you look at the storyboards?"
"I'm sorry, I guess I must have missed it."
"There's no time now to be sorry. Fix it."
"You don't have to shout."
"Yes, I do. I have to shout because I'm surrounded by idiots."
She waved her hands in the air.
"I'm about to go online and talk to $11 billion of venture capital in 5 countries and show them submicroscopic technology, except I don't have a microscope feed, so they can't see the technology."
On the bed, Julia said,
"I kind of lost it with this guy. It was so frustrating. We had a clock counting down to the satellite time, which was booked and locked. We couldn't change it. We had to make the time, and this guy was a dimbus. But eventually we got it working. Fast forward."
The screen showed a static card which read, "A private demonstration of advanced medical imaging by Zymos Technology, Mountain View, California, world leader in molecular manufacturing." Then on the screen, Julia appeared, standing in front of the gurney and the medical apparatus. She'd brushed her hair and tucked in her blouse.
"Hello to all of you," she said, smiling at the camera. "I'm Julia Foreman of Zymos Technology, and we're about to demonstrate a revolutionary medical imaging procedure just developed here. Our subject, Peter Morris, is lying behind me on the table. In a few moments,
We're going to look inside his heart and blood vessels with an ease and accuracy never before possible. She began walking round the table, talking as she went. Unlike cardiac catheterization, our procedure is 100% safe. And unlike catheterization, we can look everywhere in the body, at every sort of vessel, no matter how large or small. We'll see inside his aorta, the largest artery of the body, but we'll also look inside the alveoli of his lungs and the tiny capillaries of his fingertips. We can do all this because the camera we put inside his vessels is smaller than a red blood cell. Quite a bit smaller, actually. Zymos microfabrication technology can now produce these miniaturized cameras and produce them in quantity, cheaply, quickly. It would take 1,000 of them just to make a dot the size of a pencil point. We can fabricate 1 kilogram of these cameras in an hour. I'm sure you are all skeptical. We're well aware that nanotechnology has made promises it couldn't deliver. As you know, the problem has been that scientists could design molecular-scale devices, but they couldn't manufacture them. But Zymos has solved that problem. It suddenly hit me what she was saying. What? I said, sitting up in bed. Are you kidding? If it was true, it was an extraordinary development, a genuine technological breakthrough, and it meant... It's true, Julia said quietly. We're manufacturing in Nevada. She smiled, enjoying my astonishment. On screen, Julia was saying, I have one of our Zymos cameras under the electron microscope, here, she pointed to the screen, so you can see it in comparison to the red blood cell alongside it. The image changed to black and white. I saw a fine probe push what looked like a tiny squid into position on a titanium field. It was a bullet-nosed lump with streaming filaments at the rear. It was 1/10 of the size of the red blood cell, which in the vacuum of the scanning electron microscope was a wrinkled oval like a gray raisin. Our camera is 1/10 billionth of an inch in length. As you see, it is shaped like a squid, Julia said. Imaging takes place in the nose. Microtubules in the tail provide stabilization, like the tail of a kite, but they can also lash actively and provide locomotion. Jerry, if we can turn the camera to see the nose... Okay, there. Thank you. Now, from the front, you can see that indentation in the center? That is the miniature gallium arsenide photon detector, acting as a retina. And the surrounding banded area, sort of like a radial tire, is bioluminescent and lights the area ahead. Within the nose itself, you may be able to just make out a rather complex series of twisted molecules. That is our patented ATP cascade. You can think of it as a primitive brain, which controls the behavior of the camera. Very limited behavior, true, but enough for our purposes. I heard a hiss of static and a cough. The screen image opened a small window in the corner and now showed Fritz Liedermeier in Germany. The investor shifted his enormous bulk. I'm sorry, Miss Foreman. Tell me, please, where's the lens?
There is no lens.
How can you have a camera with no lens?
I'll explain that as we go, she said.
Watching, I said, it must be a camera obscura.
Right,
she said, nodding. Camera obscura, Latin for dark room, was the oldest imaging device known. The Romans had found that if you made a small hole in the wall of a dark room, an upside-down image of the exterior appeared on the opposite wall. That was because light coming through any small aperture was focused as if by a lens. It was the same principle as a kid's pinhole camera. It was why ever since Roman times, image recording devices were called cameras. But in this case,
What makes the aperture? I said. Is there a pinhole? I thought you knew, she said. You're responsible for that part. Me? Yes, Zymos licensed some agent-based algorithms that your team wrote. No, I didn't know. Which algorithms? To control a particle network. Your cameras are networked? All those little cameras communicate with each other? Yes, she said. They're a swarm, actually. She was still smiling, amused by my reactions. A swarm. I was thinking it over, trying to understand what she was telling me. Certainly, my team had written a number of programs to control swarms of agents. Those programs were modeled on behavior of bees. The programs had many useful characteristics. Because swarms were composed of many agents, the swarm could respond to the environment in a robust way. Faced with new and unexpected conditions, the swarm programs didn't crash, they just sort of flowed around the obstacles and kept going. But our programs worked by creating virtual agents inside the computer. Julia had created real agents in the real world. At first, I didn't see how our programs could be adapted to what she was doing. We use them for structure, she said. The program makes the swarm structure. Of course. It was obvious that a single molecular camera was inadequate to register any sort of image. Therefore, the image must be a composite of millions of cameras operating simultaneously. But the cameras would also have to be arranged in space in some orderly structure, probably a sphere. That was where the programming came in. But that, in turn, meant that Zymos must be generating the equivalent of... You're making an eye. Kind of, yes. But where's the light source? The bioluminescent perimeter. That's not enough light. It is. Watch. Meanwhile, the on-screen Julia was turning smoothly, pointing to the intravenous line behind her. She lifted a syringe out of a nearby ice bucket. The barrel appeared to be filled with water. This syringe, she said, contains approximately 20 million cameras in isotonic saline suspension. At the moment, they exist as particles, but once they are injected into the bloodstream, their temperature will increase, and they will soon flock together and form a meta-shape, just like a flock of birds forms a V-shape. What kind of a shape? One of the VCs asked. A sphere, she said, with a small opening at one end. You might think of it as the equivalent of a blastula in embryology, but in effect, the particles form an eye, and the image from that eye will be a composite of millions of photon detectors, just as the human eye creates an image from its rods and cone cells. She turned to a monitor that showed an animation loop, repeated over and over again. The cameras entered the bloodstream as an untidy, disorganized mass, a kind of buzzing cloud within the blood. Immediately, the blood flow flattened the cloud into an elongated streak, but within seconds, the streak began to coalesce into a spherical shape. That shape became more defined until, eventually, it appeared almost solid. If this reminds you of an actual eye, there is a reason. Here at Zymos, we are explicitly imitating organic morphology, Julia said. Because we are designing with organic molecules, we are aware that courtesy of millions of years of evolution, the world around us has a stockpile of molecular arrangements that work, so we use them.
You don't want to reinvent the wheel, someone said.
Exactly. Or the eyeball.
She gave a signal, and the flat antenna was lowered until it was just inches above the waiting subject.
This antenna will power the camera and pick up the transmitted image, she said. The image can, of course, be digitally stored, intensified, manipulated, or anything else that you might do with digital data. Now,
If there are no other questions, we can begin. She fitted the syringe with a needle and stuck it into a rubber stopper in the IV line. Mark time. 0.0. Here we go. She pushed the plunger down quickly. As you see, I'm doing it fast, she said. There's nothing delicate about our procedure. You can't hurt anything. If the micro-turbulence generated by the flow through the needle rips the tubules from a few thousand cameras, it doesn't matter. We have millions more. Plenty to do the job. She withdrew the needle. Okay. Generally, we have to wait about 10 seconds for the shape to form, and then we should be getting an image. Ah, looks like something is coming now. And here it is. The scene showed the camera moving forward at considerable speed through what looked like an asteroid field, except the asteroids were red cells, bouncy, purplish bags moving in a clear, slightly yellowish liquid. An occasional much larger white cell shot forward, filled the screen for a moment, then was gone. What I was seeing looked more like a video game than a medical image. Julia, I said, this is pretty amazing. Beside me, Julia snuggled closer and smiled. I thought you might be impressed. On screen, Julia was saying, we've entered a vein, so the red cells are not oxygenated. Right now, our camera is moving toward the heart. You'll see the vessels enlarging as we move up the venous system. Yes, now we are approaching the heart. You can see the pulsations in the bloodstream that result from the ventricular contractions. It was true. I could see the camera pause, then move forward, then pause. She had an audio feed of the beating heart. On the table, the subject lay motionless, with the flat antenna just over his body. We're coming to the right atrium, and we should see the mitral valve. We activate the flagella to slow the camera. There the valve is now. We are in the heart. I saw the red flaps, like a mouth opening and closing, and then the camera shot through into the ventricle and out again. Now we are going to the lungs, where you will see what no one has ever witnessed before, the oxygenation of the cells. As I watched, the blood vessel narrowed swiftly, and then the cells plumped up and popped brilliantly red one after another. It was extremely quick. In less than a second, they were all red. The red cells have now been oxygenated, Julia said, and we are on our way back to the heart. I turned to Julia in the bed. This is really fantastic stuff, I said. But her eyes were closed, and she was breathing gently. Julia? She was asleep. Julia had always tended to fall asleep while watching TV. Falling asleep during your own presentation was reasonable enough. After all, she'd already seen it, and it was pretty late. I was tired myself. I decided I could watch the rest of the demo another time. It seemed pretty lengthy for a demo, anyhow. How long had I been watching so far? When I turned to switch off the TV, I looked down at the time code running at the bottom of the image. Numbers were spinning, ticking off hundredths of a second. Other numbers to the left, not spinning. I frowned. One of them was the date. I hadn't noticed it before because it was in international format, with the year first, the day, and the month. It read 02-21-10. September 21st. Yesterday. She'd recorded this demo yesterday, not today. I turned off the TV and turned off the bedside light. I lay down on the pillow and tried to sleep. Day 2, 9:02 a.m. We needed skim milk, Toasty O's, Pop-Tarts, Jell-O, dishwasher detergent, and something else, but I couldn't read my own writing. I stood in the supermarket aisle at 9 o'clock in the morning, puzzling over my notes. A voice said, "Hey, Jack, how's it hanging?" I looked up to see Ricky Morse, one of the division heads at Zymos. "Hey, Ricky, how are you?" I shook his hand, genuinely glad to see him. I was always glad to see Ricky. Tanned with blonde crew-cut hair and a big grin, he could easily be taken for a surfer, were it not for his SourceForge 3.1 t-shirt. Ricky was only a few years younger than I was, but he had an air of perpetual youthfulness. I'd given him his first job right out of college, and he'd rapidly moved into management. With his cheerful personality and upbeat manner, Ricky made an ideal project manager. Even though he tended to underplay problems and give management unrealistic expectations about when a project would be finished. According to Julia, that had sometimes caused trouble at Zymos. Ricky tended to make promises he couldn't keep, and sometimes he didn't quite tell the truth. But he was so cheerful and appealing that everyone always forgave him. At least I always did when he worked for me. I had become quite fond of him and thought of him almost as a younger brother. I'd recommended him for his job at Zymos. Ricky was pushing a shopping cart filled with disposable diapers and big plastic bundles. He had a young baby at home, too. I asked him why he was shopping and not at the office. "Mary's got the flu, and the maid's in Guatemala, so I told her I'd pick up some things." "I see you've got Huggies," I said. "I always get Pampers myself." "I find Huggies absorb more," he said. "And Pampers are too tight. They pinch the baby's leg." "But Pampers have a layer that takes moisture away and keeps the bottom dry," I said. "I have fewer rashes with Pampers." "Whenever I use them, the adhesive tabs tend to pull off, and with a big load, it tends to leak out the leg, which makes extra work for me. I don't know. I just find Huggies are higher quality." A woman glanced at us as she pushed past with her shopping cart. We started to laugh, thinking we must sound like we're in a commercial. Ricky said loudly, "So, hey, how about those Giants?" to the woman's back as she continued down the aisle. "Fucking A, are they great or what?" I said, scratching myself. We laughed, then pushed our carts down the aisle together. Ricky said, "Want to know the truth? Mary likes Huggies, and that's the end of the conversation." "I know that one," I said. Ricky looked at my cart and said, "I see you buy organic skim milk." "Stop it," I said. "How are things at the office?" "You know, they're pretty damn good," he said. "The technology's coming along nicely, if I say so myself. We demoed for the money guys the other day, and it went well." "Julia's doing okay?" I said as casually as I could. "Yeah, she's doing great, far as I know," Ricky said. I glanced at him. Was he suddenly reserved? Was his face set, the muscles controlled? Was he concealing something? I couldn't tell. "Actually, I rarely see her," Ricky said. "She's not around much these days." "I don't see much of her either," I said. "Yeah, she's spending a lot of time out at the fab complex. That's where the action is now." Ricky glanced quickly at me. "You know, because of the new fabrication processes." The Zymos fab building had been completed in record time, considering how complex it was. The fabrication building was where they assembled molecules from individual atoms, sticking the molecule fragments together like Lego blocks. Much of this work was carried out in a vacuum and required extremely strong magnetic fields, so the fab building had tremendous pump assemblies and powerful chillers to cool the magnets. But according to Julia, a lot of the technology was specific to that building. Nothing like it had ever been built before. I said, "It's amazing they got the building up so fast."
Well, we kept the pressure on. Molecular Dynamics is breathing down our necks. We've got our fab up and running. We've got patent applications by the truckload. But those guys at Moldyne and Nanotech can't be far behind us. A few months, maybe 6 months if we're lucky.
So you're doing molecular assembly at the plant now? I said.
You got it, Jack. Full-bore molecular assembly. We have been for a few weeks now.
I didn't know Julia was interested in that stuff. With her background in psychology, I'd always regarded Julia as a people person.
She's taken a real interest in the technology, I can tell you. Also, they're doing a lot of programming up there, too, he said. You know, iterative cycles, as they refine the manufacturing.
I nodded. What kind of programming? I said. Distributed processing, multi-agent nets. That's how we keep the individual units coordinated, working together.
This is all to make the medical camera?
Yes. He paused.
Among other things.
He glanced at me uneasily, as if he might be breaking his confidentiality agreement.
You don't have to say, I said.
No, no, he said quickly.
Jeez, you and I go way back, Jack.
He slapped me on the shoulder.
And you got a spouse in management. I mean, what the hell?
But he still looked uneasy. His face didn't match his words, and his eyes slid away from me when he said the word spouse. The conversation was coming to an end, and I felt filled with tension, the kind of awkward tension when you think another guy knows something and isn't telling you because he's embarrassed, because he doesn't know how to put it, because he doesn't want to get involved, because it's too dangerous even to mention, because he thinks it's your job to figure it out for yourself, especially when it's something about your wife, like she's screwing around. He's looking at you like you're the walking wounded. It's Night of the Living Dead, but he won't tell you. In my experience, guys never tell other guys when they know something about their wife. But women always tell other women if they know of a husband's infidelity. That's just how it is. But I was feeling so tense, I wanted to...
Hey, look at the time, Ricky said, giving me a big grin. I'm late. Mary'll kill me. I've got to run. She's already annoyed because I have to spend the next few days at the fab facility. So I'll be out of town while the maid's gone.
He shrugged.
You know how it is.
Yeah, I do. Good luck.
Hey, man, take care.
We shook hands, murmured another goodbye. Ricky rolled his cart around the corner of the aisle and was gone. Sometimes you can't think about painful things. You can't make your mind focus on them. Your brain just slips away. No, thank you. Let's change the subject. That was happening to me now. I couldn't think about Julia, so I started thinking about what Ricky had told me about their fabrication plant. And I decided it probably made sense, even though it went against the conventional wisdom about nanotechnology. It was a long-standing fantasy among nanotechnologists that once somebody figured out how to manufacture at the atomic level, it would be like running the 4-minute mile. Everybody would do it, unleashing a flood of wonderful molecular creations, rolling off assembly lines all around the world. In a matter of days, human life would be changed by this marvelous new technology, as soon as somebody figured out how to do it. But of course that would never happen. The very idea was absurd. Because, in essence, molecular manufacturing wasn't so different from computer manufacturing, or flow valve manufacturing, or automobile manufacturing, or any other kind of manufacturing. It took a while to get it right. In fact, assembling atoms to make a new molecule was closely analogous to compiling a computer program from individual lines of code. And computer code never compiled the first time out. The programmers always had to go back and fix the lines, and even after it was compiled, a computer program never, ever worked right the first time, or the second time, or the 100th time. It had to be debugged, and debugged, again and again, and again. I always believed it would be the same with these manufactured molecules. They'd have to be debugged again and again before they worked right. And if Zymos wanted flocks of molecules working together, they'd also have to debug the way the molecules communicated with each other, however limited that communication was. Because once the molecules communicated, you had a primitive network. To organize it, you'd probably program a distributed net, of the kind I had been developing at Mediatronics. So I could perfectly well imagine them doing programming along with the manufacturing. But I couldn't see Julia hanging around while he did it. The fab facility was far from the Zymos headquarters. It was literally in the middle of nowhere, out in the desert near Tonopah, Nevada. And Julia didn't like to be in the middle of nowhere. I was sitting in the pediatrician's waiting room because the baby was due for her next round of immunizations. There were four mothers in the room, bouncing sick kids on their laps while the older children played on the floor. The mothers all talked to each other and studiously ignored me. I was getting used to this. A guy at home, a guy in a setting like the pediatrician's office, was an unusual thing. But it also meant that something was wrong. There was probably something wrong with the guy. He couldn't get a job. Maybe he was fired for alcoholism or drugs. Maybe he was a bum. Whatever the reason, it wasn't normal for a man to be in the pediatrician's office in the middle of the day. So the other mothers pretended I wasn't there. Except they shot me the occasional worried glance, as if I might be sneaking up on them to rape them while their backs were turned. Even the nurse, Gloria, seemed suspicious. She glanced at the baby in my arms, who wasn't crying and was hardly sniffling. "What seems to be the problem?" I said we were here for immunizations. "She's been here before?" "Yes, she had been coming to the doctor since she was born." "Are you related?" "Yes, I was the father." Eventually, we were ushered in. The doctor shook hands with me. He was very friendly, never asked why I was there instead of my wife or the housekeeper. He gave two injections. Amanda howled. I bounced her on my shoulder, comforted her. "She may have a little swelling, a little local redness. Call me if it's not gone in 48 hours. Then I was back in the waiting room, trying to get out my credit card to pay the bill, while the baby cried. And that was when Julia called. "Hi, what are you doing?" She must have heard the baby screaming. "Paying the pediatrician." "Bad time?" "Kind of." "Okay, listen, I just wanted to say I have an early night. Finally, so I'll be home for dinner. What do you say I pick up on the way home?" "That'd be great," I said. Eric's soccer practice ran late. It was getting dark on the field. The coach always ran practice late. I paced the sidelines, trying to decide whether to complain. It was so hard to know when you were coddling your kid than when you were legitimately protecting them. Nicole called on her cell to say that her play rehearsal was over, and why hadn't I picked her up? Where was I? I said I was still with Eric, and asked if she could catch a ride with anybody. "Dad," she said, exasperated. You'd think I had asked her to crawl home. "Hey, I'm stuck." Very sarcastic.
"Whatever."
"Watch that tone, young lady." But a few minutes later, soccer was abruptly canceled. A big green maintenance truck pulled onto the field, and two men came out wearing masks and big rubber gloves with spray cans on their backs. They were going to spray weed killer or something, and everybody had to stay off the field overnight. I called Nicole back and said we would pick her up.
"When?"
"We're on our way now."
"From the little creeps practice?"
"Come on, Nick.
Why does he always come first?"
"He doesn't always come first."
"Yes, he does. He's a little creep."
"Nicole."
"Sorry."
"See you in a few minutes." I clicked off. Kids were more advanced these days. The teenage years now start at 11. By 5:30, the kids were home raiding the fridge. Nicole was eating a big chunk of string cheese. I told her to stop,
It would ruin her dinner. Then I went back to setting the table.
When is dinner?
Soon. Mom's bringing it home.
Uh-huh.
She disappeared for a few minutes, and then she came back.
She says she's sorry she didn't call, but she's going to be late.
What? I was pouring water into the glasses on the table.
She's sorry she didn't call, but she's going to be late. I just talked to her.
Jesus. It was irritating. I tried never to show my irritation around the kids, but sometimes it slipped out. I sighed. Okay.
I'm really hungry now, Dad.
Get your brother and get into the car, I said. We're going to the drive-in. Later that night, as I was carrying the baby to bed, my elbow brushed against a photograph on the living room bookshelf. It clattered to the floor. I stooped to pick it up. It was a picture of Julia and Eric in Sun Valley when he was 4. They were both in snowsuits. Julia was helping him learn to ski and smiled radiantly. Next to it was a photo of Julia and me on our 11th wedding anniversary in Kona. I was in a loud Hawaiian shirt, and she had colorful leis around her neck, and we were kissing at sunset. That was a great trip. In fact, we were pretty sure Amanda was conceived there. I remember Julia came home from work one day and said, "Honey, remember how you said my ties were dangerous?" I said, "Yes." And she said, "Well, let me put it this way. It's a girl." And I was so startled, the soda I was drinking went up my nose, and we both started to laugh. Then a picture of Julia making cupcakes with Nicole, who was so young. She sat on the kitchen counter, and her legs didn't reach the edge. She couldn't have been more than a year and a half old. Nicole was frowning with concentration as she wielded a huge spoon of dough, making a fine mess while Julia tried not to laugh. And a photo of us hiking in Colorado, Julia holding the hand of 6-year-old Nicole while I carried Eric on my shoulders, my shirt collar dark with sweat. Or worse, if I remembered that day right. Eric must have been about 2. He was still in diapers. I remember he thought it was fun to cover my eyes while I carried him on the trail. The hiking photo had slipped inside its frame, so it stood at an angle. I tapped the frame to try and straighten it, but it didn't move. I noticed that several of the other pictures were faded, or the emulsion was sticking to the glass. No one had bothered to take care of these pictures. The baby snuffled in my arms, rubbing her eyes with her fists. It was time for bed. I put the pictures back on the shelf. They were old images from another, happier time, from another life. They seemed to have nothing to do with me anymore. Everything was different now. The world was different now. I left the table set for dinner that night, a silent rebuke. Julia saw it when she got home around 10.
"I'm sorry, hon."
"I know, you were busy," I said.
"I was. Please forgive me."
"I do," I said.
"You're the best."
She blew me a kiss from across the room.
"I'm going to take a shower,"
she said. And she headed off down the hallway. I watched her go. On the way down the hall, she looked into the baby's room and then darted in. A moment later, I heard her cooing and the baby gurgling. I got out of my chair and walked down the hall after her. In the darkened nursery, she was holding the baby up, nuzzling her nose. I said, "Julia, you woke her up."
"No, I didn't. She was awake."
"Weren't you, little honey bunny? You were awake, weren't you, poopsie doopsie?"
The baby rubbed her eyes with tiny fists and yawned. She certainly appeared to have been awakened. Julia turned to me in the darkness.
"I didn't. Really, I didn't wake her up. Why are you looking at me that way?"
"What way?"
"You know what way. That accusing way."
"I'm not accusing you of anything." The baby started to whimper and then to cry. Julia touched her diaper.
"I think she's wet,"
she said, and handed her to me as she walked out of the room.
You do it, Mr. Perfect. Now there was tension between us. After I changed the baby and put her back to bed, I heard Julia come out of the shower banging a door. Whenever Julia started banging doors, it was a sign for me to come and mollify her. But I didn't feel like it tonight. I was annoyed she'd awakened the baby, and I was annoyed by her unreliability, saying she'd be home early and never calling to say she wouldn't. I was scared that she had become so unreliable because she was distracted by a new love, or she just didn't care about her family anymore. I didn't know what to do about all this, but I didn't feel like smoothing the tension between us. I just let her bang the doors. She slammed her sliding closet door so hard the wood cracked. She swore. That was another sign I was supposed to come running. I went back to the living room and sat down. I picked up the book I was reading and stared at the page. I tried to concentrate, but of course I couldn't. I was angry, and I listened to her bang around in the bedroom. If she kept it up, she'd wake Eric, and then I would have to deal with her. I hoped it wouldn't go that far. Eventually, the noise stopped. She had probably gotten into bed. If so, she would soon be asleep. Julia could go to sleep when we were fighting. I never could. I stayed up, pacing and angry, trying to settle myself down. When I finally came to bed, Julia was fast asleep. I slipped between the covers and rolled over on my side, away from her. It was 1 o'clock in the morning when the baby began to scream. I groped for the light, knocked over the alarm clock, which turned the clock radio on, blaring rock and roll. I swore, fumbled in the dark, finally got the bedside light on, turned the radio off. The baby was still screaming. "What's the matter with her?" Julia said sleepily. "I don't know." I got out of bed, shaking my head, trying to wake up. I went into the nursery and flicked on the light. The room seemed very bright, the clown wallpaper very yellow and burning. Out of nowhere, I thought, why doesn't she want yellow placemats when she painted the whole nursery yellow? The baby was standing up in her crib, holding onto the rails and howling, her mouth wide open, her breath coming in jagged gasps. Tears were running down her cheeks. I held my arms out to her, and she reached for me, and I comforted her. I thought it must be a nightmare. I comforted her, rocked her gently. She continued to scream, unrelenting. Maybe something was hurting her, maybe something in her diaper. I checked her body. That was when I saw an angry red rash on her belly, extending in welts around her back and up toward her neck. Julia came in. "Can't you stop it?" she said. I said, "There's something wrong," and I showed her the rash. "Has she got a fever?" I touched Amanda's head. She was sweaty and hot, but that could be from the crying. The rest of her body felt cool. "I don't know. I don't think so." I could see the rash on her thighs now. Was it on her thighs a moment before? I almost thought I was seeing it spread before my eyes. If it was possible, the baby screamed even louder. "Jesus," Julia said. "I'll call the doctor." "Yeah, do." By now, I had the baby on her back. She screamed more, and I was looking carefully at her entire body. The rash was spreading. There was no doubt about it. And she seemed to be in terrible pain, screaming bloody murder. "I'm sorry, honey, I'm sorry," I said. "Definitely spreading." Julia came back and said she left word for the doctor. I said, "I'm not going to wait. I'm taking her to the emergency room." "Do you really think that's necessary?" she said. I didn't answer her. I just went into the bedroom to put on my clothes. Julia said, "Do you want me to come with you?" "No, stay with the kids," I said. "You sure?" "Yes." "Okay," she said. She wandered back to the bedroom. I reached for my car keys. The baby continued to scream.